Yes, I'm joined by the Pet Chat team. It's Cheryl Shaw and Dr. David Tabrett today. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Nice to have you. Now, Cheryl, we'll start with you.
Yes.
Because you've got a little brooch on that looks like a dog house.
Oh, it's actually a house, and we're going to be going inside the house today to have a look at the flooring.
Oh, okay. So the types of floors that animals
slip and slide on. So there's some dangers sometimes with the floor choices that we have.
And a bit of fun too.
Yes.
With the zoomies. And David, what have you got for us today?
Well, I've done some homework, Amanda.
Good.
From a caller last week. Paul from Chisholm rang in. So we've got an update there. And also to talk about blood transfusions. Sometimes our pets need a blood transfusion.
We're going to start with slippery floors, Cheryl.
Yes. Look, slippery floors, we sometimes don't realise that our pets can have issues with floors. Now, it depends on the surface. If you've got tiles or even floorboards and lino, that can actually create a problem for some dogs with being able to not just move across the floor, but how they actually negate that surface. So some dogs will actually stop and will not walk. They'll refuse to go on slippery floors. And often that's because they have had a fall. And when they've had a fall, they lose their confidence. And obviously sometimes they get injured as well. So there's all of that memory recall of when I walk across there, there's a potential for problem. So they will sometimes change how they walk. So they change the way they walk across the floor, and by changing the way they move or their gait, it actually makes their body a lot tenser. And so when we do that, that also can impact on the dog. So things like hip dysplasia, and if they've got arthritis, that change of movement can exacerbate those conditions for them. So we've got to look at what we can do to minimise the amount of stress we're putting on our dogs. So putting down things like rugs, obviously, and runners, stuff like that. You can use yoga mats. They're often a good thing, or children's foam mats. But making sure that the floor surface that they're walking on is going to actually support them, particularly with young puppies. Now, young puppies don't have very good coordination. And when they get those zoomies and they start running, they can actually slip and slide. And if they slip and slide, they're going to have that memory recall of when I go near that, I get hurt. Older dogs, particularly dogs like golden retrievers, as they're quite a large breed of dog, when they get down on a slippery floor, they have difficulty getting up again. So instead of being able to, you know, rise from being in a laying position, they just slip and slide, their legs will splay out, and obviously they can damage themselves. So we need to be mindful of both our young dogs and our older dogs. But it can be any age that can have an injury from falling on a floor. Some of the other things you can do, if it's on stairs that are slippery, you can actually put in, if they're external stairs, you can use things like the artificial turf. That will often help. Some dogs really, when they slide down a step, that's it. They won't go up or down them again. They will just stand there and wait to be transported, obviously carried by you, down or up those stairs. So it is something that we've got to be mindful of, because that anxiety of that slippery surface is very real to them. And we don't want to increase their anxiety, but we also don't want them to be walking in a fashion that's actually doing more damage to their ligaments and their body.
I suppose it's like a human as well. You know, you have one fall and you might have hurt your leg a little bit, and then you're readjusting your walk, and all of a sudden you've wrecked your other leg because you're not walking properly, and other stuff's going on. So it's the same with animals.
It is exactly the same. That's some precipitation. It's where the body adjusts itself. We have a sense that we move in a certain way, and that's the way we move. But when there's an injury or a fear, we alter that. We brace, or tense, so that we don't injure ourselves. But in fact, we're actually causing more issues. So just be mindful. Watch how your dog does move across surfaces. And another thing from a grooming perspective, I really am very keen always to make sure dogs have their paws shaven so that the hair isn't over their pads, because they can't get traction. If hair is sitting on their pads, that will act like a little floor polisher and off they'll slide. So that's one thing that's important to check the pads that aren't covered with hair. Another thing is paying attention to the dog's nails. If nails get long, they'll strike the floor before the pad and the pad can't get traction, so they'll actually slip. So keeping nails nice and short is important too for these dogs that are on slippery surfaces. But just be mindful, watch how your dog moves, and if there's problems, you know, start addressing it by putting down different surfaces so the dog can move through that area.
And I suppose polished wooden floorboards would be bad as well.
Yeah, anything that's slippery. And, you know, obviously when things are wet, it's even more increased that possibility of a fall. But, yeah, there's so many surfaces in our house we don't realise can, you know, pose a problem to some pets.
Right, that's good advice. Dr. David Tabrett has done some homework. He's been a busy boy.
Yeah,
and tell us what you've been doing.
So last week we had a call from Paul at Chisholm who asked a question about pets flying and whether they experience anxiety or even the swallowing and the air in your ears, you know, equalising. So it was a good question because obviously we would have seen that there's moves now to allow pets in the cabin in certain circumstances. So I went and had a look around, did a bit of reading, and including both here and overseas. And the recent proposal was first suggested from Virgin Australia in there. So they've got a whole set of guidelines, which you can all go and read about, but essentially small, less than 8 kilos, approved carriers, things like that. So that's fine, but that didn't really answer the question. There was nothing in that that answered the question. So there's also the Civil Aviation Safety Authority has a whole set of guidelines around assistance dogs travelling on commercial flights. And so I had a look at that. Again, a whole set of very nice guidelines, very well laid out, but again, nothing that actually addressed the questions that were asked. So we went a bit further afield and I've looked at a couple of studies, in one in Canada, which was a what we call a prospective study. And that is where they actually said, okay, we're going to look at these dogs and we're going to do this and then we're going to see what the outcome is. And there was 24 beagles that needed to be flown across the country, and they took some blood from the dogs before, and half the dogs they sedated and the other half without sedation, and then they observed them during the flight, and then at the other end they take more blood, and then they compare things like they're looking at heart rate, they're looking at movement, agitation, panting, all signs that could be of disturbance, anxiety symptoms. But they also looked at in the blood things like cortisol and adrenaline and so on. Essentially from that was that most dogs actually do experience stress if we rely upon the usual markers that we look at for pets. And so most of the dogs that were transported did show signs of stress. Interestingly, the sedation had no impact. There was no difference between dogs that were sedated and dogs that were not sedated prior to that transport. Now, having said that, I would say the medication that they used it's commonly used for dogs in transport, but I think we've got better medication, and I couldn't find a study that actually uses better anxiolytics or sedatives associated. One of the problems is, and this is reinforced in some other information, which I'll get to in a sec, is that when you sedate an animal, it removes some of its ability to respond both to its environment and, you know, if it vomits or something, it's now sedated, and that's risky. So generally, the suggestion is we should not be sedating dogs for transport because we're removing their ability to maintain an airway, for instance, and things like that. So the Australian Veterinary Association recently endorsed a policy around all of this, in particular whether certain breeds should or shouldn't travel. And there's some studies going back a long time, and there's another one which I'll talk about in a sec, which comes from Canada, worldwide, that shows that there are risks associated with brachycephalic, or these animals that have pushed-in faces.
Like a pug or something?
Pugs, bulldogs, there's a whole series of dogs that we would be familiar with that, you know, they do have a risk of airway breathing. There's a couple of other things that emerge from those dogs as well. They have an increased risk of reflux, also, and just their whole upper airway anatomy predisposes them to obstruction, and they're unable to regulate body temperature as well. One of the things I mentioned about anxiety before was panting and so on, and those dogs overheat. And in particular, if we look at brachycephalics, they don't deal with that very well. The problem you get is that if the dog is in a transport container and not just in front of you, is there's no ability to intervene. And so, you know, the dogs are put into transport containers into the baggage hold, which is environmentally temperature regulated and so on, but nobody's checking on them because it's just impossible. So the general rule, particularly the Australian Veterinary Association says, is to not allow or take brachycephalic animals flying, and certainly sedation is frowned upon and not recommended. And finally, the big one was this study that was a worldwide study. So it was the US, Germany, Australia, and where was the other one? There was, I've just got the record here. Germany, or two people in the US were researching on this. So in the US, they reckon around about 6% of dogs fly every year, which I thought is amazing. Like, that's huge. So it's about 2 million dogs, animals flying every year, and dogs make about 60% of them. So it's quite a lot. And I think this is one of the things, and probably where Paul's question comes from. In Australia, we haven't seen this. Now, maybe it's because our flights are longer, you know.
They've got a larger population as well.
They've got a larger population, but there's a lot more airports that they hop, you know, from one to the next. Even though the US is a big place, there's a lot of short flights. And so I think it's certainly a different culture. So this particular worldwide study was an owner-reported survey, which always has a lot of bias, right? Because, you know, do you recognise stress, particularly if you're not seeing your pet during the flight? That's why I like the Canadian study, because it kind of, they had blood tests that show the stress. And this dog, this study, interestingly, about a third of people said they thought their dogs were probably a little bit stressed. But otherwise, they said, no, dogs cope well, except for the two dogs that died in the study. Now, there were 635, I think it was, results over 12 months. So it wasn't small, but there were two dogs that died. Both of them were brachycephalics. So there is a lot of information out there. The rules I said right up front was we frown upon the use of sedatives, and you can get your dog, or you should get your dog examined by a veterinarian prior to any planned air travel. And in fact, for most people, the best thing to do is, if you do need to fly a pet, is to actually talk to a transport company, and a pet transport company, because they have the proper protocols in place, rather than just trying to do it yourself. But definitely seek a vet's opinion on whether your pet should fly, and if they need medication, you actually, from the Virgin website, it says you have to present a letter as to why your pet requires medication to fly. Otherwise, they will refuse the pet going on board.
Right. Yeah. Geez, you have done your homework, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. It was really interesting. I appreciated the call. Thanks, Paul.
Yeah, well, hopefully Paul's listening. And we have Jenny from Fern Bay on the line. Hi, Jenny, how can we help you?
Hi. I don't need help, but I was listening to you with dogs on planes.
Mm. Yeah.
Now, I have an assistance dog.
Yes.
Right. Now, she would be allowed on them anyhow. But my assessor told me, she said, if you're going to go on a plane trip, go out to the airport and get your dog used to the noise, know, again and again, because otherwise they'll be scared stiff.
Yeah, it definitely, there's an acclimatization process, isn't there?
Yeah.
And I think particularly I notice is that with Williamtown, of course, with the RAF base, it's a lot louder than most airports are pretty noisy, but Williamtown is really noisy.
Yeah. Well, if you got her used to that, you could get her used to anything, probably.
Just about, you know? Yeah. So has she ever been on a plane with you?
No, not yet. No, I've got no intention.
Sure.
But can I just say something also about another situation I had?
Mm-hmm.
I was at my church one night, at night time. Anyhow, I went in and my dog started to pant and, oh, you know, she was shocking. I thought, oh, my goodness, what's wrong with her? Anyhow, I took her out to the car and she settled down. And apparently there was a faulty fire alarm in the building.
A faulty?
We couldn't hear it, but she could hear it.
Oh, okay.
It was on the blink, you know, so it.
Yes, okay. Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah. Oh, their hearing is amazing, you know.
She's definitely gets the job as an assistance dog.
Oh, sure does. I wouldn't be here if I didn't have her, I can tell you.
Good on you, Jenny. Thank you for calling and giving us that update. Yeah,
we appreciate it. Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Pet of the week. Benny is a one-year-old mixed breed, and he's a pretty cute little fella.
Oh, he's so happy. Look at him smiling.
Well, I smile too in photos. Nobody's adopting me, though, which I'm sad about.
Your wife did.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I know. She put up with me. Right. But Benny, he might be a bit more trouble because he likes to play all the time. He's a one-year-old mixed breed, so he likes tug-of-war. He's very boisterous, big personality, but he likes to snuggle as well.
Yeah, he's got a big heart.
Yeah, see, I've got that in
common.
Common.
That's right. That's right.
Probably went down the wrong path, didn't I, Cheryl?
Yes. Let's talk about Benny.
All right. And but he also loves to search around the yard. So, again, making sure we've got a secure yard because I think Benny's the sort of dog who, if the fun's outside the fence, he wants to get out there.
Mm.
So make sure your fences are well in place. And but he's quite happy to stumble down, get on the lounge with you, and settle into his home. So he's looking to, particularly for a home that can devote the time for his exercise, his training, and mental stimulation. He's currently in foster care with family, with kids, but and seems to be okay with other dogs. So, again, as always, if you talk to adopting dogs in any circumstance, or buying dogs for that matter, you want to make sure they're suitable for your home.
That's right. Next, we've got Abigail, our cat. And actually, if you look at the picture, she's just sprawled out on the bed like a lady of leisure.
Very relaxed.
It's a great photo. Have a look at that one.
Yes. And Abigail, interestingly, 2.5-year-old now, has had a litter in the past and de-sexed. So just to make sure that you understand what you're getting. Loves company, hasn't been with other animals, but cats are always, again, you've got to have the environment for them. Loves to have a lot of mental stimulation, which I think cats, the more time you spend with them, the more they give you back. And I think Abigail's going to be like that for anyone who takes her on.
Mm. It looks like she likes company. They said she hasn't been tested with other cats or dogs, but they think that with her personality, she'll be fine with all three, and that includes humans and little kids as well.
I would add, though, Amanda, I think even if they have said she's been with other dogs or cats or people or whatever, it's a different house, different household.
True.
So
that's true.
Just got to take each one as you go.
Well, if you'd like to check out Abigail and Benny, you can head to our website, 2NURFM.com.au. Dr. David Tabrett wanted to talk about blood today, so let's do that.
Yes, well, specifically blood transfusions as a treatment. And what do we tend to use them for? So some of our listeners may have had their pets that required a blood transfusion, and these can indeed be a life-saving measure. So I guess the most obvious thing is if your pet loses blood, maybe it's trauma, etc., we might want to replace that blood. So there's a need for a blood transfusion. Other reasons could be that they're quite anemic to the point where they're not able to deliver oxygen through to the tissues. And this includes a more common problem that we see, which is a disease called immune-mediated hemolytic anemia. So the body's own immune system breaks down the red blood cells, heme, being the red blood cells, lysis or lytic, that's breakdown. So you get anemia because the body breaks down its own red blood cells. It's a terrible disease. Other reasons we could see is bleeding disorders, such as RAP-8 anticoagulants are a common cause where we might reach for a blood product. Now, before we go any further, we'll just touch on this, is that our blood is made up, and dogs and people are similar. I'm not going to say the same. Otherwise, I'll have people come in saying they want to donate blood out of their own veins for their pet. We can't do that. I'm sorry. But our blood contains water, and then it contains red blood cells, white blood cells, platelets, proteins such as albumin and other blood proteins, things like those clotting factors I talked about, also antibodies against diseases that, for instance, pets may have been vaccinated, they would have created antibodies against diseases. So it's got all these different components, and we can use either the whole blood or we can use parts of the blood to treat conditions. So one of the things, though, is that when we do that, we need to collect blood from another animal. Now, we have the benefit of being able to purchase and buy in blood from donor dogs, which has been completely collected and processed in a facility. And we can store that, but we can only store it for 30 days and then it goes off, goes stale, because it just starts, the red blood cells start to break down. If we transfuse them, we call them old, and you can see them under a microscope. They're all shriveled up and they don't work very long. They don't last very long. So it's kind of a bit dangerous. There's inflammatory proteins. So we have to throw the blood out after 30 days. So there's a bit of a tension there between storing blood and then using it within a time frame. One of the things, though, that we can do is we can actually separate the blood into different parts, including plasma, and then we can freeze the plasma for up to 2 years. And we can continue to, we can use it after 2 years, but if we use frozen plasma, we can treat things like rat bait anticoagulants, poisoning. We're not going to treat anemia, though, because plasma doesn't have red blood cells in it. So it still has use, which means we could separate and use red blood cells on its own and then plasma. And that way we can treat two animals from the one donation, which is a fantastic thing. And then what we do is we want to actually have the patient that we need to treat with IV fluids, intravenous fluids, and then we need to monitor them very closely just to make sure they don't have a reaction. So it takes a fair bit of work to do a blood transfusion. And hopefully that's going to reverse the disease condition that the pet is, and we, you know, get a healthy pet at the other end.
Sounds good. And if people want to donate their blood, the pet's blood?
Contact your local veterinarian.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. That was Pet Chat for this week. We'll catch up with you next week.
Thank you.
2NURFM.